Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. You're too kind. You are all too kind. Please. Thanks. Thank you so much. Welcome. Welcome to the very first Late Night. I am Seth Meyers. I'm your host, and we appreciate you all tuning in this evening.
Hey, everyone. Seth Meyers here. On February 24th, 2014, I took over as the host of Late Night on NBC. I've officially been doing the job for 5 years this week, and I wanted to commemorate this anniversary by doing something special. So in today's episode, I am going to be taking a look back through the years with some members of my staff and crew who have been with us since the beginning. I wanted you to get to hear from them and get to hear all the things they do behind the scenes to make the show that we're so proud of. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Hey, everybody. I'm here with Fred Armisen. My longtime friend.
Seth, how are you?
Good. We've known each other 17 years.
Yes.
Isn't that crazy?
It's insane. 17 years.
You know, this is about the five-year anniversary of this show. It was very unplanned, this connection that you have with our show, that you would be the band leader at this show. And yet, and I think this oftentimes happens in probably any business, but particularly show business, there's just some weird twist of fate makes something happen that it's hard to imagine it without, which is, we were moving forward with no plan at all about what the music on this show was going to be. And we were talking about, should we have a DJ? Should like a band not be a part of this? Like, what kind of band should it be? And at the 11th hour, I think it was only weeks away, right?
Oh, yeah. It was very, very late in the game.
Lorne suggested that you do it.
Yeah.
And what was great was that it was not going to be, you know, it wasn't going to be a comedy band. This was Fred, not Fred the comedian. This was Fred the musician. And one thing that we have similar tastes in is music.
Yes.
And so I felt this great comfort because I know what I like, but I don't know how to talk about it or describe it.
Right.
And talk real quick about how, once we came to that conclusion, like how quickly you pulled the band together and what you were trying to achieve.
That part was easy because I just thought of, first of all, who's in town? That's an important part of it. You can't go flying people around. And right away, I knew this band, Les Epifav, friends of mine I've played with, who were also the right age, meaning not yearning to go out on tour or anything like that. They had families. And then Eli from another band I knew in the 90s, Girls Against Boys. So that part was very easy, getting the musicians together. And I was on guitar. And then we had Kim Thompson on drums. She had played with Beyonce. So it was very, that part was actually easy. So we didn't have, like, aside from drums, we didn't have auditions or anything like that.
I was
right. Like, and Seth, by the way, Seth Jabor, the guitar player, I knew he was a sort of secret weapon. I was like, that guy makes beautiful music. And then maybe a week later, it was 8 days later, we got a second guitar player, Marnie Stern, another old friend of mine, someone I'm a fan of, and there was the band.
Had we just been a DJ show, would you have been into that? Would you have been our DJ?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What I would have done is I would have been your DJ, but hired a DJ.
Oh, meaning?
Meaning we're both on stage.
I might give it up for Fred, and then what happens? We cut to you, and you just, what do you do?
It's a little bit like an Andy Warhol thing, where like, I'm there, and I've got headphones, but I'm not doing the actual work.
And we don't see the guy who's doing
the
actual.
I think you see him, but you sort of.
But we know it's not you doing the work.
You know, people who aren't familiar with the format would be like, oh, I think Fred's doing it.
Right.
But people who really know the biz would be like, I think it's that guy.
Right.
Or girl.
We could fall back on that.
Yeah.
I love you. Thank you for being a part of the show for the last 5 years.
My pleasure. I love it. I really do.
Let's keep doing it.
Yes.
All right. Fred Armisen, everybody. I'm here with Amber Ruffin now. Amber, you've been here from the very beginning.
Yeah, baby.
One of our first writers.
Yay!
Do you remember the day you got hired?
Yes, I do. I came into the room and I saw John Lutz and I saw Pete Gross. Now, John Lutz and Pete Gross were teachers of mine back in Chicago 5 million years ago. So that was like the coolest, neatest part. Like, you're great. But I couldn't believe that I got to work with my old friggin' teachers. They didn't remember me, but...
They really didn't remember you.
I think they did. I don't think they knew that they had taught me. They knew that they had seen shows.
You had come from the Chicago world. We didn't really cross over, but we both did Boom Chicago in Amsterdam.
Yes.
Which is, for those who don't know, an improv comedy theater started by some Chicago guys in Amsterdam.
It's the best place a human being can be, and it's the most fun a person can have.
When we started the show, I did have this idea that I wanted writers who could do sketch comedy because I thought we would do sketchy type things and it would be great to have the writing staff. And we sort of went away from that. And then writers kind of found their way back on camera being a little bit less sketchy and a little bit more pointed. Were you surprised at how well that worked out for you?
I mean, I certainly didn't see that coming. When I got this job, I didn't think we were going to be on camera ever at all. So that was shock number one. I think what is more shocking is the content. Every little bit I do on the show, I can't believe that I work with people who can help me talk about these crazy issues, but then also love it.
It sounds cliche to talk about representation, but even I had no idea, because I really like the idea of having a diverse writing staff, I didn't realize how much the show would get out of it. I thought it would be nice to have a writing staff that had different points of view, but it's that realization of, oh, I mean, you bring stuff all the time to writers' meetings that I think, oh, that's so great, and I also care about that issue, but I never would have approached it from that angle.
Yeah. You spend so much time doing what you think people want you to do that, boy, oh, boy, once you just start doing what you feel like, that's the thing you're supposed to be doing this whole time. I wish I could go back in time. That wouldn't have believed me.
The other thing that I have found so joyous is I feel as though the audience knows it's what you want to be doing. I don't ever think the audience is thinking to themselves, I wonder who wrote that for Amber. They can tell it comes from your heart.
I think so. I mean, I hope so. Every once in a while, someone will be like, who wrote that for her to say? And I'm like, yeah, who did do that? That's crazy.
You knew Jenny from a long time. You guys were Chicago friends. Yeah. And she's obviously been a great person out of the writer's room. And Jokes Seth Can't Tell has been such a wonderful bit. And I think we were looking. I think the last one was our 27th.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
Every month we look at the last one and then marvel at how big the number is.
It's really great.
This time we went 26, are you sure?
Another thing you do on the show that brings me great comfort is when we do day drinking, you come on set. You're there as I slowly lose my composure.
You guys, this man is probably my same size. Are we not the same size?
I am bigger than you.
We're the exact same size. And he drinks like you wouldn't freaking believe. While we were cutting together day drinking with Ina Garten, Seth cut out some of the shots he took because he thought seeing him doing all those real shots would be too much and no one would believe that it was real. But it was. And he drank it. And it's amazing. And I do drunk history. You're the drinking champion of the world. And couldn't give a rip the next day tooting around like nothing has happened. I can't frigging believe it.
We do sometimes, every now and then, do some old school sketches. And we're going to shoot a pilot with you. And the day we found out that we were shooting an NBC pilot, do you want to tell everybody what you were dressed as? Because Mike Shoemaker and I called you in our office to give you the good news. And you were dressed as?
A Cabbage Patch Kid. But gosh, like a human being who had undergone surgery to look like a life-size Cabbage Patch Kid. So, like, my head was twice as wide as my body, but all made of plastic.
And we had to give you this news, and it was really strange because your expression was it was established. You could not change your expression, so we just had to look into this weird doll's head to try to judge from your eyes if you were happy or not. Amber, it has been such a joy to work with you for 5 years. I hope we continue to work together in some capacity. I hope it's here. I hope you're as happy about our first 5 years as I am. Happy anniversary.
I love you too.
Hey, everybody. We're here with our head writer and, for my money, America's greatest living joke writer, Alex Bass.
Very nice. Thank you very much.
We met at Weekend Update.
We did.
And you were the head writer Weekend Update when I left. And I know I've told people this before, but you are the one person that I absolutely had to bring with me from SNL. And you were also the one person that Lorne Michaels told me I could not take.
Yes. And I remember I went up to him at the finale party. And I think I said to him, like, oh, well, hey, congratulations on a great season. And he goes, yeah, you're not leaving. That's what I remember. And I was like, oh, okay, this is going to take some work.
And part of the work that it took was that you actually did both jobs for a while. In 2014, we launched this show in February. In September, we were hosting the Emmys, and over the course of that time, you were also on the weekends still writing for Weekend Update.
I was on Saturdays. I was going in. So, and Saturday is a 14-hour workday,
yeah.
I think. Yeah, and I remember I lost like 25 pounds during that period, and when we got to the Emmys night, did a great job. Lauren came in to give a toast, and I couldn't stand up. That's what I remember. It's like, I just waved my champagne glass at him.
You actually went...
Like, this might be too much.
You went to a medical tent.
I went to the medical tent on Emmys Day. And they're like, you seem fine. I was like, I'm really not. I am out of jokes, you guys.
You were fully depleted of comedy.
I
that was
wrung out.
And now you fully work here, and we are very happy about that.
It's so nice having one job.
One job is really... if you can just have one you like, it's really...
Oh.
One of the things that you do every day is not only write a great deal of monologue jokes, but you also put the monologue together with everybody else's jokes. We read our jokes to as close as we can get to a dress rehearsal audience. I am wearing a sweatshirt. I am sitting at the desk. I'm reading the jokes off paper. Mm-hmm. And it can be an eclectic mix of people that we sort of find at 4 p.m.
I feel like it's always eclectic.
Yes.
It's people who are taking a tour of an office building in the middle of a week.
Yeah.
Or shopping at a souvenir store.
And based on that as your audience, do you feel like you have a pretty good ear for what's going to work 2 hours later for our audience?
I feel like they always give you something. And you know going in, like, what are the best two or three jokes in the pack? And so you kind of go off of that. I'm like, oh, the best joke got a titter. So I'm like, okay, anything that got half a titter, we're throwing in.
Right, it's just you rescale it.
Yeah, you rescale your expectations. And, you know, I'll stand there with Steve, our stage manager, and watch them come in. And we're sort of assessing as we go. I'm like, oh, it seems very foreign, or there are a lot of oldies today, or it's smaller than usual. And I'll just start making expectations. Yep.
There can be, it can be too young. Sometimes
absolutely
you realize, oh, there's a you know, high school in town for something, and they might not quite be ready for a political dissertation.
Yeah. My favorite is when there's a joke in the pack that's about Uruguay, and then somebody in the audience is from Uruguay, just watching them react. It's like they can't believe Uruguay got mentioned.
Also, it's that thing, if it's not even a mean joke about Uruguay, but you feel the rest of the audience get tight because they now you're roasting. They're worried. They think that you did it on the fly.
Yeah, well, they're like, it's like a trench mentality. They're like, oh, our buddy from Uruguay is really getting it. Oh, man, we don't have to take this.
We've talked a lot over the years about how comedy writers, and we love ours, man. Our staff, the best.
The best.
They do sometimes fall in love with their own jokes.
Every comedy writer, I still do.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to learn how to eat that. But, man, when you're a young comedy writer... It's so hard. You're so convinced you're right. And I've been there. I get it. I see them do it, and I want to help them. And, you know, they just have to, you know what they have to do? They have to get older.
Yeah. That's really the only solution for a comedy writer falling out of love with their material.
Yeah.
Is age.
Yeah.
You are not alone among late night comedy writers of having lived and worked in the era before Donald Trump and after Donald Trump. How would you compare the two?
The Donald Trump era is good in that audiences always know the news, because he will have done one or two very crazy things on any given day, and the audience comes in and they're like, we know about the thing and we're expecting jokes about the thing. So it makes that easier. Then he does the same things over and over and over again, and it's like, oh, this is my eighth time around writing a joke about something stupid he said that he said eight more other times, and it's so hard to find a fresh take.
Yes. You do it better than most.
Thank
better than
you.
Anyone. So I've been very lucky over the course of my career to have you. And I remember when I first told my dad about you, he was like, oh, don't ever let him get away. So great. In my first explanation of what Alex Bass was, he knew that.
I love that we've come from him threatening me on a regular basis to an appreciation.
Yes. Thank you, Alex Bass.
Thanks, boss.
Hey, we're with one of our producers, Eric Lederman. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. How's it going?
Good. So you sit with one of our other producers, Mike Shoemaker, at a little table that I go over to during the commercial breaks.
I do.
And one of the things you make sure is happening over the course of the show, basically, is that everything's running smoothly, including that everything is happening to time.
To time.
What is the main thing you are concerning yourself with during the taping?
During the taping, the first thing is making sure that you have enough time to talk to each guest so where it feels like we have a complete interview. And the wonderful thing about this, having timed other shows, is that you, I just want to say for our listeners, they're going to love this, Seth Meyers respects the clock.
I do.
He's so good with the clock. He makes my job very easy and a second producer's job very easy. And if we're under or over for like the total show, we'll adjust the time. So let's say a closer look went a little long, a comedy piece went a little long or a little short. We'll either add more time or take away. And whatever it is, God bless you, Flex.
It's the one thing my wife and I most have in common is we respect the clock.
Respect the clock.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's a very key part of our marriage is neither of us is ever late.
See?
There you go.
That's why it's successful.
You are sort of in charge of the band. That is a safe thing to say, right?
Yes, for sure.
You were a drummer yourself.
I was, yeah.
And you kind of came up with an idea that was sort of born out of necessity, which is the guest drummers. Do you want to speak about how you had that idea and what it's grown into over the course of 5 years?
Definitely. As we all know, Fred Armisen formed the AG band. We decided in the history of the show, it was like Lauren, when there was like, it was going to be a DJ, and it wasn't. And then Lauren, like, hey, Fred is going to curate a band for us? And I was psyched because I thought it was going to be like a DJ and we were going to have to do that. Fred puts this band together. Fred's playing guitar. Eventually, long story short, Fred switches to drums. And then when Fred was on guitar, we had another guitar player. We had Seth Chabor. And then when he left, it's like, well, we don't really need another guitar player. You can always get by. And when a drummer leaves, you can't lose the heartbeat of the band or else you have a completely different band.
Right.
Like instrumentals. So being that I was a professional player for years and freelance TV and music and was constantly hustling both things in Los Angeles, luckily for me, I'm like, I think I know some dudes. And I'm like, let's call Chad Smith from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Let's just go big. And then he shows up. And then I'm like, wait, I know a lot of people. And if I don't, all my endorsers or gear, they'll hook me up. Because we're going to give the drummer some. And then it kind of evolved into this thing where when Fred's not here, we have the best drummers in the world.
One of the things that's really lovely for me, and I don't have a great ear for music, but I have over the course of the last few years realized how each drummer brings a different DNA to how they even play something like the theme song.
Right.
But also how grateful they all are. You realize how rarely a spotlight is shown on a drummer.
Yes.
And
did the drummer sum is the whole thing.
And at this point, I would imagine you have a fairly long list of people who are willing to come here and spend a week with us.
Now it's totally overwhelming. And it's a million emails and a million, you go to like a show and it's like, hey man, is that the dude who works the drums? Yeah. And then I'm always like, well, actually I co-run the show. And they're like, yeah, cool. Why is my boy coming into play? And it's all very, it becomes a thing. It becomes like you're a booker. So I have a lot more empathy for people who book talent or, you know, Jeremiah or Hallie who are always booking people.
You've like, created a nightmare.
I've given myself extra work to fulfill my childhood fantasies. But also to your point earlier about drummers, I could do a 20-page, you know, thesis on drummers in late night and how they've always been the centerpiece, from Ed Shaughnessy with Carson and up to like Quest and now Fred and Letterman doing like drum solo week and always commenting on the drums. The drums, you know, from big band has always been the center of comedy. And if you have a great Max Weinberg, you know, if you have a good drummer holding down the band, you're going to have a very even show. But we just take that gamble every week on someone different, I guess.
And Fred did, you know, come in and curate this band, and I was sort of agnostic about what I wanted the music to be, but now it's impossible for me to consider us not having live music. Would you have enjoyed this show a great deal less if we were working with a DJ every day?
I think absolutely. I think it would have been the wrong tone.
Yeah.
I think the vibe would have been wrong, especially like, you know, since the show is obviously dealing with a lot of political content and political times as complicated and as easy as they are, then you just like bump in like with a pop song or something like that. I think it just, and I don't want to say cheapens it, but live music engages the crowd, engages you. It's almost like I can tell when you're really moved by something. And even if a drummer like starts something, like, you know, ends the song too early and like you haven't sat down yet or sits it down at the right time, it changes the energy in the room. And you'd lose that, I think, with playback of music.
And it has been fascinating to watch just how exponentially better a drummer gets over the course of a Monday show to
yes.
a Thursday show.
And, oh, that's cool. Glad
and it's a fun
that.
Thing to watch. Thank you, buddy, for an incredible 5 years.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me. This is the best.
Thanks, Eric.
All right. Bye.
Hey, we're here with Hallie Raff. She's a producer and head of our talent department.
Hello.
Hallie, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So for people who don't know, you are in charge of basically all of the guests on our show.
Yep.
And you run a talent department that also covers music and any walk of life kind of guest. How has booking changed for you over the course of 5 years?
Well, I think we stick to this traditional format, lead guest, second guest, third guest, which is music or stand-up or demo segment. But I think since 2016, when Trump became president, I think that things have shifted. I think there's more of an appetite for politics and newsmakers, and there was a big pivot, and I think we're doing a lot more of that.
I mean, it seems like our guests have diversified over the course of the 5 years. Does that make your job more interesting?
It does. And I think, you know, we have our department, there's people that focus on film and television and politics and comedians. And so every day it's like we get to just, our job is consuming everything and learning more about everything. And I think, you know, you do a great job with the newsmakers. I love the idea that you don't use blue cards when you're interviewing people. It just seems much more like a conversation and not you looking at cards.
It helps when there are guests that I'm interested in and engaged with, so I really appreciate that you constantly deliver those for us. We did try in the run-up, even before he announced, we were talking to Donald Trump.
Yes.
And we thought just based on the correspondence dinner,
yes.
he would be such an interesting guest. And you had a very interesting point person in trying to book Donald Trump.
Yes, my point person was Michael Cohen.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a traditional booking where I'll email a publicist or an agent. There was some back and forth. They have a movie coming out. This was months of getting on the phone with Michael. Michael had to speak to you and Mike Shoemaker, our showrunner. And Donald got on the phone with President Trump got on the phone.
Thank you. We do. Even in the podcast, we have to use the proper titles.
And he got on the phone and it was just surreal. The booking never happened, but the whole experience of talking about what we could and couldn't say and having you apologize for the remark at the correspondent dinner about how he was a joke, that was all
yes.
discussed.
One of the caveats that we always made it clear that we would not meet
yes.
was that I had to apologize for the correspondence dinner.
Yes.
And looking back on it, I you know, I certainly have no regrets about him not being here, but you have since you've run into Michael Cohen, and now I think he's sort of looking for any life raft he can find. He has, you have engaged with him in the last year.
Yes, I see him around town. We live near each other. I run into him at lunch. And, you know, I have to say, you know, he always comes up and feels bad for everything that happened. And, you know, now he's going to be.
You will not be running into him at lunch for a period
a
of time.
A little bit, yeah.
What is, or who have been, I should say, some of your favorite bookings?
I think, you know, Bernie Sanders, when we had him first before anybody had him on the show, that was exciting. Nobody knew who he was. And now
yeah.
we have a relationship with
yep.
him. I think Biden, our first week, was great.
He was
so,
our first show.
Yeah,
fantastic.
With Amy Poehler. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, you know, I grew up with David Letterman. So he doesn't do many talk shows or late night shows. And he came here and it was 4 years of really working with Tom Keeney, who's his publicist, and all the stars aligned. So that's always exciting when you work for a long time on a guest.
And I should say, not that I ever doubt you, but it was a full 4 years of you saying, I think we're getting closer. And you were not lying, but it was very gradual. It's exciting for me. You know, obviously there's a lot of talk shows right now, and it is still really fun for me when you go to say hello before a show to a guest who's never been on a talk show before. Yeah. Is finding new talent for you part of it that's really still exciting?
It is. And I think oftentimes when you find somebody before they've, you know, made it big and you bring them here first, it's so exciting to see how they are backstage and how excited they are. And then you grow with them as their career grows. And I think spotting those people is always exciting.
And I heard you have a question for me. True?
True.
Okay, what do you got?
Okay, before the show, I come get you. We, you know, meet the guests and you do the show every day. And I'm amazed that every day, no matter if you're not feeling great, if you had a tough day, if you haven't slept last night, how do you kind of psych yourself up to always be like ready to go and deliver every night? Because I know there's days at my desk that I'm like, I don't even want to talk to anybody.
I have those days at my desk, it should be noted. I just have to turn it on for basically a period of 90 minutes. But I will say, those when you come and get me and we start walking down the hall together, it is really does come into focus for me. Oh, I'm about to go say hi to people that I cannot believe I get to talk to for work. That's the part of the day where you are reminded, oh, this is special. Because to be honest, look, I love working in this office building, but until like 4, I work in an office and then I get to work on a TV show. So that's a short answer.
It's like the Saturday Night Live days too.
Yes, exactly. thank you, Hallie. Thanks for 5 years.
Thank you.
We are here with our camera operator, Gene Kelly. Hello, Gene.
Hey, Seth. How's it going?
Good. Myself, the writing staff, I believe our audience at this point, we all fell in love with your voice as soon as we heard it. So it's really nice to have it in podcast form.
Thank you. It's so different. For the way I hear my voice is not the way you hear it, obviously.
Right.
So it's nothing special to me.
Well, that's good, because if you heard it the way I heard it, you wouldn't be able to get anything done. When this show started, you were about to retire to Tampa Bay, and you thought it would be a couple months. It's been 5 years. Why are you still here, Gene?
Well, it's a long story, Seth. No, I fell in love with the show. I said I'd try it, and I fell in love with the show. First of all, the staff here. It's like family. I mean, I've been in the business 42 years, and I've never been accepted as much as I have here. It's a wonderful feeling coming to work.
It is a...
And you're not a bad guy either.
Thank you very much. Well, I feel exactly the same. I couldn't have said it better myself. One of the things that I think probably happened for you that had not happened in any of your previous jobs either is you were put on camera. My writing staff did fall in love with you as a sketch performer. Is that something that you ever saw happening?
No.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out for the life of me what they saw or heard that they wanted to put me in front of a camera and doing skits. And I was like, me? Because I was always a behind-the-scenes person. And when they asked me, it was like, are you kidding? So I tried it, and before I knew it, I was being asked again and again. And I said, what's going on here? And from that came another opportunity with regard to Joe Pera.
Joe Pera, an incredibly funny comedian who has a show on Adult Swim.
They called me and asked me to, they being his friend and I guess producer, Connor O'Malley.
Who used to write here.
They called me and asked me to fly to Buffalo in 2 days to do a film. And I went, what? You got to be kidding me. So I turned him down and I said, you know, I have obligations here. So some time went by, and they called me again, and they said, we're doing a TV series. Would you be involved? And before I could turn them down, they said, well, we spoke to Seth, we spoke to Mike Shoemaker, and they've approved of you, giving you some time off. And I went, oh, there goes my out. So I did it.
And it's wonderful, and I highly recommend everybody watch it. And I will say, of all the things you expect in television and show business, the one they never tell you is that one day your cameraman will come and say, I'm going to weigh for 2 weeks to pursue acting. you are a news junkie, so does working the show, is this nice for you? Do you enjoy that part of it?
When the show took a turn after the presidential election, it hit my sweet spot. I love politics. I love news. And coming to work was like a way of keeping up. Anything I didn't read, I'd get at work and to be entertained.
One of my favorite things when we do our sort of run through with about, you know, 40 people we find in the building, and I really like a good Gene laugh at dress rehearsal. I hope you know how much I appreciate those.
Well, you know, I'm wearing a headset, so I don't hear how loud I am. You know, when it gets to me, I just let it go, and I realize if I'm going to enjoy it, I have to do it in dress.
Yeah.
I can't do it during the show because things are so funny that the camera shakes. Right.
I know this was going to be your last act. I'm so glad it's still going. And happy 5 years, Gene. We're so happy that you've been here from the start.
I cannot believe it's been 5 years.
Isn't it crazy?
But it's
crazy.
Been great.
It's been a great 5 years. Yes. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. I'm here with Sal Gentile. Hi, Sal.
Hello.
Sal, for those of you listening, writes The Closer Looks, which is quite an undertaking. And obviously, our show would not be our show without that. You started as a segment producer.
I did.
And do you remember how you transitioned into being a member of our writing staff?
You wanted to do something, a news story about ISIS or something like that. And you just asked if I had any ideas or if I could help at all. So I came into your office.
Early versions of Closer Looks, I would generate out of my office.
Right.
And I started realizing you were very smart about a lot of different things. And so I would bring you in to make sure I didn't look dumb. That's my memory of it.
I just remember you asking if I had any other ideas, like
yes,
for things that we could do on a semi-regular basis before it was even called A Closer Look. We did originally do stories, as impossible it is to think now, that had nothing to do, because he wasn't a politician, type with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Like, we did one that I still think of to this day because it was so fun to do, on the Greek debt crisis.
Yeah.
Again, that was before we even called these A Closer Look, and we would give them each individual names, like,
yeah,
based on what the story was about.
I remember I would be out and I would run into people, and I remember Greek debt crisis was one I would hear about, and I would hear about, we did one on Planned Parenthood, those hearings.
And that was A Closer Look. That was one of the first ones that was like labeled as A Closer Look.
My memory of that exercise was, I think, one of the first ones that taught us we could do it in a day.
Yes.
Because it was really a case of us all standing around and watching those hearings and realizing there was enough if we moved quickly to pull a piece together.
That's right. Because now we have a very streamlined process where I write it the night before and I send it in and then we work on it the next day. But that was one where the hearings started at 10 a.m. So we didn't even start to like pull together a script on that until the middle of the day.
One of the things that I sometimes say to people as far as how our staff has morphed over the course of doing the show is that adding A Closer Look as an element that happens three times a week is we had to increase our research staff, our graphic staff, because that obviously time-wise is the longest piece in the show. Explain how you work with them in pulling that piece together, what they're doing over the course of the day while you're writing, and especially writing as the news is happening.
I sit at sort of like a Professor X style, like with many monitors, and I'm constantly communicating with them at all times. And they're just an incredible, like, sort of rapid response team that they can immediately find or proactively pull something in advance. Like, especially our video researcher, Emily, and our editor, Tony, like, they work fantastically as a unit together and just, like, proactively pull stuff. Or, like, the State of the Union is, like, a perfect example. Like, I will literally just say, like, that clip of Nancy Pelosi making that face behind Trump or whatever, and they'll just immediately pull it. And also, we pull together, like, very difficult montages of things. Like, our favorite magnum opus that they proactively work on now that's great is our ongoing montage of Sean Hannity for no reason whatsoever bringing up the P-tape allegations on his show. And that's a perfect example of they are constantly on red alert for any example of that and constantly like collating all of those examples. And our graphics team, that is one of the most fun parts of the job. We get to like ask for them to make something insane.
This would be an example that they would find out at around noon that they have to make Donald Trump as a werewolf chasing someone across the
world. Or like a while ago, there was one that we struggled with all day and then they ended up making a real example. It was, I don't even remember what the story was, but it was a deer laughing. And we had to make it look like the graphics team had to come with a way to make it look like a deer was staying on its hind legs and like keeled over with laughter.
Right.
And we spent all day like debating, how is this going to look? How are people going to know the deer is laughing? And then it like played well. And it was like, yeah, the graphics team did it.
You know, the last live show we did was the State of the Union. That's not a very long turnaround. Do you enjoy those nights in that you at least don't have to worry about it too much the night before?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I always worry about a little bit because you just don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
So like, I do like it in the sense that you have no time to think about it. So you can't second guess yourself or be precious about anything. Like, we just have to like write stuff.
And I also enjoy seeing everyone else like scramble to get stuff together.
Yeah, those nights are fun for that reason.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's interesting when you put a show together, you have an idea of what it's like and you pick a lot of writers and not a day goes by that it doesn't go unnoticed to me that you obviously write the most on the show just based on the fact that this is the longest piece of the show. We do it 3 days a week and the fact that you did not come through a natural channel. I feel incredibly lucky to have you here.
Oh, thank you. I feel incredibly lucky to work here.
Well, happy 5-year anniversary.
Happy 5-year anniversary.
I'm here with our director, Alex Wietmeyer. How are you, Alex?
Hello, Seth. Doing well.
So we met because of this show.
Yes.
We didn't have a director. We found you. And obviously, the show has changed a lot. And one of the ways the show has changed is, I think when we first started, we knew our bits a few days in advance.
Yes.
And now, because of things like A Closer Look, the first time you get to rehearse them is day of, same as myself.
Yes.
What is the hardest part of that for you?
It's not even the hardest part, but what I try and do is make sure that everything that's normal is all lined up so that we can react to the stuff that comes last minute.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, that's last minute graphics or news stories that we have to get into either a monologue drop-in or into A Closer Look. And we have that hard deadline to get you out in front of the monologue audience to get good laughs. And so we don't want to delay that because then the audience gets soft.
Right.
So the hardest part is just making sure that we get you out on time or as close to on time as possible so that we get some good laughs from the monologue
audience. We do a monologue rehearsal every day at around 4:15, which is my first chance to get a sense of how things are going, your first chance to get a sense of how things are going. If A Closer Look ends up being 10 minutes, usually goes into 12, 13 minutes, is it hard in that two-hour gap making the edit down from 13 to 10 because Sal will make cuts and then they get to you? Is that the scramble for you guys?
For the control room, taking out is always easier because
right.
we can just remove things.
Mm-hmm.
Sal comes back with like 5 minutes, 10 minutes before we start taping and goes through it one last time with us. I think that's after he reads through cards with you.
Yes.
That's the hard part because if he sees a picture that's just not quite right, or if I saw one earlier and I'm like, Sal, is this really the picture? Then we make those last minute phone calls. Graphics has to scramble to try and get us one so that we can get the picture in there in time.
Pretty quickly into a show, I have a sense of, oh, this is, it's not necessarily good audience or bad audience, but this is an audience that rounds off their laughs really fast.
Yep.
This is an audience that claps instead of laughs, or this is an audience that laughs enough that it will give me a bed to maybe go off script a little bit more.
Yes.
Can you judge it pretty quickly now as well?
Yes. I think we probably both judge and are making the same judgment calls. Like that laughter and that applause is kind of like music.
Yeah.
And so we have to feel that rhythm together if we're having a good day or as close to together as possible so that I'm not changing the picture over your shoulder before you're ready to move on and before the audience is ready to move on. Like all three have to kind of be in sync together so that they're done processing, you're not going to make an ad lib, and we're moving.
I have always said to people, I feel for me, once the guests are coming out, I feel as though my day has ended and now I just get to talk to interesting people. I contend, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, that might be the hardest part of your job because now you are off a script. You're watching two people have a conversation trying to figure out where to go.
It depends on who you're talking to.
Who are the hardest people for me to talk to for you to direct?
Your friends.
Why is that harder?
Because you talk to them like they're your friends.
Okay.
So it would be like if you go to a bar and you're sitting at the bar having a conversation with someone, where do you look? You know the stories that they're telling just as well as they do. And so the interjections are a lot more sporadic.
Sure.
Some would call them natural, but on television, it's almost unnatural because you're not used
right.
to people being that in tune with each other.
And I think also it's the comfort of knowing that I am not being rude when I interject.
Right, exactly.
I try to stay very out of the way when guests are telling stories.
Yes, you have a way of always making it about the guest. And you even do that with your friend. Even if you were the center part of the story, it's still, but how are you feeling when this happened?
Right. And for those listening, because I think they would find it very interesting what somebody who directs a late night talk show did right before. What was your last job before this one?
Nikki and Sarah Live on MTV was the job I had immediately before this.
And before that?
Before that, I was at 106 in Park. And before that, I was at Fashion Queens and Watch What Happens Live.
Have you ever been anywhere this long? Is this your longest running gig?
This is my longest running directing gig.
Gotcha.
When I was starting, I was at Fuse Television for a very long time.
Gotcha.
Probably
well,
10 years.
I am very lucky to be the beneficiary of your 5 years directing the show. Happy anniversary.
Happy 5th anniversary.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Seth.
We're here with one of our producers, Hillary Hun. Hillary, welcome.
Thank you.
I've known you for a very long time. You were at Saturday Night Live when I started. You then left to work on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, and then you came and joined us. I believe you have the hardest job, the most overlooked, which is you help bring a writer's vision to life.
They have a vision in their head, but sometimes they're not so great at putting it on the piece of paper.
So would you say that you serve as a reality check for them, or sort of someone who is taking them on a journey to create a successful project?
I think it's both, along with some of my ideas pushed in there too. So if they say, oh, someone's going to fly across the room, okay, but we're in a very small studio, so you're going to hit audience heads, and how are we going to do that? And but then also, like, you do a game show, and, oh, maybe we need an assistant type, like a Vanna White or something like that. So it's kind of directing things to make it easier for whoever is performing, or just to get it live, or if it's a pre-tape, to be able to manage all that.
You have obviously been working with sketch writers for an incredibly long time, and I imagine that experience comes into play for you constantly. What was your first year at SNL?
1993.
A day must not go past that you don't find yourself pulling from the encyclopedia of sketches you've worked on.
It's absolutely true. That's like the foxhole of
yes.
of producing, because you do every kind of show that there is. And I had done a bunch before I got there, but, you know, you have to do it sometimes in 20 seconds, or sometimes, you know, you have a day or two to kind of figure it out. But
we did a sketch recently. The conceit of the sketch was we introduced a senator. It was actually a fictional senator named David Jimenez. And then a bunch of other fictional people came out to announce that they were running for president. How do you, when that comes to you, what is your first thought as far as how are we going to produce this?
We need to know when it's going to air and if there's any room with that or not. And with that, there were so many extras that we had to cast. So how quickly can we do that? And for that specific one, a couple of the people who were running had books, or they all had books, but only a couple mentioned that they had photos. So we had to figure out, not only do we have to do this in 2 days, but now all of them have photos, so we have to take their photo as well. And because they're extras, we don't happen to have their photo on hand. So if they also need two different outfits, because one is for the show and then one is what's on their book cover. And so it's trying to think of all those things.
No writer I know would have thought that meant a second outfit.
Right.
Yeah. And I will say, this is just a side note, all those extras, we let them take home their books.
Yes.
And I think
they were very, very happy.
Well,
we let them take home the book covers.
Oh, not the actual
books.
Because
the books are our inventory.
Right. One of the things you fight against, which the writers have a great deal of appreciation for, is censorship on the show. So who is the person who would call you with a problem? And when does that phone call usually come?
So there's two people. There's Standards, who's kind of the person who talks about inappropriate words.
Sure.
That kind of thing. And there's Legal, who talks about saying something that's not true or something that can get us in trouble.
Legal, it strikes me that more often than not, the outcome of a phone call from Legal is we put the word allegedly into a joke.
That is a good one. Or, like, recently we had talked about Trump. Sal had written that Trump slept with a porn star, which he never admitted to, but we could say that he paid hush money to a porn star. So
right.
Sometimes it's just a couple little words that make it.
Tweaks.
Yeah.
And fortunately with this president, even when you have to tweak it, it ends up at a place that's perfectly fine.
Perfectly fine.
For the comedy. I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, the transition from SNL to Late Night with Jimmy must have been the bigger transition. Has this transition from Jimmy to us been as major?
Not as major, but completely different. And I think I did learn from SNL to Jimmy how much things change and how much you don't know what's going to happen. So to be flexible and to kind of figure it out, you know, what we thought when we were coming here is there was going to be no sketches and it was going to be just straight talk. And then obviously that's not true anymore.
Yes. Yes. Give writers time and they will find a way to make life harder for Hillary.
Or be on camera.
Or be on camera. They do like to be on camera.
They do.
And you don't even like to be on a podcast. So thank you so much for getting past your own fears and being
You're
here.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Hillary. Hi, we're here with Jeremiah Silva. He is a talent executive. in charge of music. Hi, Jeremiah.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So you were in music. You were booking at VH1. What made you want to come and do a job like this?
Okay, without sounding too schmoozy.
Yeah.
So I loved working at VH1. I felt like I had the best job in the world. Like, I was discovering bands. I was going out all the time. And what we did at VH1 that I thought was so cool was we got behind bands really early. And we were part of breaking them. Like, big bands like Adele and Lorde. Like, some of their first TVs, I was part of that.
Yeah.
So I thought that was super cool. But this is where the schmoozy part comes in. You were like my favorite part of SNL.
Oh,
like,
you,
I loved Update. So when I heard that you were getting the show, I was like, I need to get that job. Like, I loved you, and I loved the idea of being at a 12:30 show because I could continue doing that, like breaking bands. So I called everyone that I knew, like in music, to try to get my name in here. Like, nothing happened for a really long time. And then I got a call to come in, and I met with Hallie, and I had like a feeling that it went really well. And she said, okay, we'll have you come back, whatever. Nothing happened. She called me when I was on vacation in Spain. I was like, can you come in tomorrow? I'm like, no, I'm in Spain. But she's like, when do you get back? I'm like, on the 7th or whatever. She's like, okay, come in the 7th at 9 a.m. I'm like, fine. So I was in Mexico, supposed to fly back on Sunday, changed my flight to come back on Saturday so that I had the whole day to prepare to come in here. My flight got canceled. So I was rebooked for Sunday. I'm like, it's fine. My flight gets diverted to Boston. We land at 1 a.m. There's no train, no plane, can't drive because the roads are iced over. I had to get up at 4 a.m. to take like a 5 a.m. Amtrak in. My boyfriend worked in Stamford, so he got out at Stamford, made me take his bags. I get out at Penn Station. I have all of our bags. It's pouring rain. I can't find a cab. I walked home, took a shower, came in, met with Hallie and Shu. I didn't know this at the time, but Hallie told me later, I made no sense. I didn't know what I was saying. She's like, thank God I already decided to hire you because you were like a complete loon. But then I went to work my first day back after 2 weeks off for Christmas break, and I got a call and they had offered me the job. And I was like, what? Oh my God, I can't believe it.
Well, after everything went wrong for you, it would have been really unfair for us to pile on the other thing of you not getting the job. You have been very proud of having some new artists. Can you name some of the new artists you've had here that we put on first as far as late night?
I mean, it's like maybe one of my proudest things, because having like a feeling about somebody and being able to be part of the story is like so amazing. Like people like Alessia Cara, the 1975, 21 Pilots, like some of their like first or very early TVs were on the show. And when that happens and you don't know what's going to happen, but you have a feeling, and then a few months later, like, the songs are all over the radio, or come January or the end of the year, and they're nominated for Grammys or performing on the Grammys or win Grammys, and you feel like you're a part of that story, like, to me, is like, still such a high.
Have there been any, because you are so much more plugged into the music world than I am, are there any ones that I've recommended to you and said, I think they'd be good, that you like?
Yeah, there's a few. First one, Sturgill Simpson, I wasn't up on, that you right. totally turned me on to, and now he's like a friend of the show, and he's so amazing. We went out to see his show together
in D.C.
It
was great.
It was so fun. Also, like, Father John Misty. Yeah. I was preferably aware of him, but I didn't realize, like, how great he was until you turned me on to him. Yeah. And now, like, he's another friend of the show, which is so cool.
We now have to, of course, talk about Mariah.
I mean, what's there's so much to say.
On 1 to 10, how big a fan of you?
I mean, probably like a 36.
Yeah, so this has been something that's been very clear. And so you were working very hard to book Mariah on the show. Do you want to talk about what Mariah wanted when she came on the show?
First of all, I'll just preface this by saying Mariah Carey is the reason why I moved to New York and wanted to work in the music business.
So I owe her. Like, I personally owe her, because I'm very glad you're here.
She'll be back.
Yeah.
Don't
that's
worry.
That's what you say.
It's like my life's goal to have her perform on this show for myself. I have some other goals for you. But
thank you.
I have been working on Mariah since I got here.
Uh-huh.
Finally, I felt like all the pieces came into place and she wanted to come on the show.
Yeah.
They said that she didn't want to just sit on the couch and do an interview. I was
right.
like, okay, what does she want to do? So it was Christmas. You know, she's the queen of Christmas. She was doing a Christmas concert residency at the Beacon Theater.
Yep.
She wanted to do the interview in a sleigh.
Yeah.
My first reaction was, where do we get a sleigh in a day's notice in December in New York?
Yeah.
That's tough, but we have an amazing prop department who got one. And then, how do I explain this to Seth that she wants to do it in a sleigh? And at the end of the day, you were like, okay, fine.
Yes.
Like, let's do it.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great.
Yeah, I will say it genuinely was a Christmas gift to me because it has been the most wonderful thing to be able to talk to each other about for the 2 years since it happened.
Yeah,
it is one of my favorite things. How much you wanted her, how you finally got her, how we had to have a sleigh. And it is truly, with no exaggeration, one of my favorite moments on this show.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah. She'll be back.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeremiah. Thanks for 5 years.
Thank you.
We are here with a couple members of our studio crew, Kenny Coyle and Ryan Fox. Hi, guys. How are you?
Hello, Seth. Yeah,
what's going on?
How long have you two known each other? Because you're very good friends. And I don't think, did it start at the show or was it previous?
Yes.
It did. So what shows were you working on before this one?
Okay. I work every show in this building. SNL, Today Show, Tonight Show, Late Night when it was Jimmy. And when this show was starting, I had friends telling me, watch out for this guy, take him under your wing, really protect him, help him out. And it turns out he's running the floor. He's running everything. And it was just a friendship that, you know, just started right
on.
It blossomed. Yeah.
That's very nice. So that you can be honest about what we've all seen blossom. Now, for those who don't know, give as short as you can what a studio crew member does over the course of our show.
Sure. So, like, Kenny and I are utilities. In film world, that's like a grip or camera assistant, and that's basically we just set up every camera and anything video related. So any monitors or we make sure the cameramen don't trip, basically.
Gotcha.
That's the most
important.
You make
sure
thing.
I don't trip as well.
Right.
Of course.
When I cross the floor and I want to appreciate you, no trips.
Always
5 years
out.
In, no trips. Kenny, you've been on camera a couple of times. Have you enjoyed your acting work on the show?
The first time, I did not. But once I heard you giggle, I was like, okay, this could work.
Well, I do think that the writing staff was drawn to putting you in things because you do have a personality that they thought would be fun on camera. So the longer it's gone, the more you've enjoyed doing it?
Yes.
That's good.
Yes. Just the first one with Seth Reese putting me in with that long one we did, the B plot.
Yeah. That was like a full film.
Yeah. I was like, all right, this is a lot of critiquing. Kenny, we want you to be you. But say it like this. And I'm like, I wouldn't say it like that. And he goes, well, we need you to say it this way.
Well, now most of the stuff you do is in studio in front of an audience.
Yes.
You get to do things like bully me in character. I know you wouldn't do that as a person. Yes. Is that fun?
It is. It is a lot of fun. The last one we did where you went around chewing out the crew, that was fun, especially when we were going like eye to eye and nose to nose. That was cool.
And then you do not, this is not something you want for yourself, right?
No, I would prefer to stay behind the scenes.
You enjoy watching the show, though? Do you have a favorite bit when you're sitting there in the studio? Are you happy? Oh, on this night, I'm glad we're doing this.
Obviously, Closer Look is just, you know, that's elevated the show and just puts a certain importance and pride. You know, it's like there's something really powerful about that segment that just, you know, makes us feel great coming into work knowing that. You know, there's some good still left in the world, and there's
I feel
you're
the
doing
same
a great
way
service,
about doing that as well. But you know, it is serious, and I do think we're talking about important things. And yet, Kenny, you take advantage of me, and sometimes we do this thing called press conference where I grab a notepad. It's a prop notepad. Yeah. It's a blank notepad, and yet you have taken the advantage to write a few things down.
Yes, of course. The thing is, the day that it happened, the first time you seen it, I was expecting you to see it during like rehearsal.
Yeah,
and I completely forgot. Like the guys did not rip the page out, and then when show was happening. And I seen you look down at the pad. I was like, oh, no. Like, and it was good to see, like, I almost got you to break, but it was cool. It was very cool, especially the laugh afterwards.
Yes. I want people to know at home that you have your own talk show and you think you're on top of the world, but at any given point, a crew member could pull a prank on you that you then see on camera and have to maintain your composure.
Oh, of course.
Ryan, you enjoy music, and guest drummers, are there favorite guest drummers you've had over the time?
Jimmy Chamberlain, Danny Carey. It's just been incredible, especially since Eric and I, Eric Lederman, have such similar tastes in music. So some of his favorites are some of my favorites.
That's sort of more hardcore, more heavy metal?
I mean, rock.
Rock. Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
which
rock
now
general.
Like feels like heavy metal because there's so little rock music in the world. You guys are also, I don't know if you know this, you're the king of vacations. That whenever we come back from a two-week break, I feel like you guys have done the best job. multiple trips since in the 5 years we've done the show, multiple trips to the Far East. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate.
You guys are just living your best life.
Yeah.
And that's really, that's Kenny because he's pushed me to, I mean, I've loved Japan. I've loved going to China and everywhere, but he's been pushing me. He wanted to go there. He wanted to see it. And I guess I'll go. I didn't really think it was going to happen. And then he just kept saying it over and over for months. And then eventually we booked the tickets, and it was like, okay, he's forcing a friendship on me, and now he's forcing a trip on me, and it turns out it's just the best thing ever.
I am genuinely happy because you guys do have such a great friendship. I'm so happy it started here. Yes. I'm so happy you guys are here. Mm-hmm. Happy five-year anniversary.
Happy
dudes.
5 years, Seth.
Thanks, guys.
Yes. Thanks.
I'm here with Wally Ferriston, everybody. Wally is our beloved cue card guy. That's the right name for your job, yeah?
Yeah. I'm your average cue card guy.
Not your average.
Well, okay.
You run a cue card empire.
Yes,
Wally.
This is true.
We've known each other for 18 years because you have done cue cards at SNL for how long now? What year was your first year?
My first year was 1990.
Wow.
So I'm going on 19 years.
Sorry, 29 years. My God.
I jipped myself.
And you still work at SNL, but Monday through Thursday you work with us.
Yes.
And one of the questions I get asked the most often in the Q&A is why we are not a teleprompter show. And what I try to get across to people is you know me so much better than any computer would.
Yes, yes. I know your rhythms, I think. I think we work pretty well together over so many years. And yeah, it's just a really comfortable thing. And that's the reason I took the job in the first place when you started the show. I went to Mike Shoemaker, who produces the show, and I said, you guys using cue cards, which I figured you were going to. And I said, I want to do cards and run the show because I didn't want Seth to worry about the day-to-day of the cue cards. I wanted you to worry about the writing and all the other stuff that's important. I didn't want you to have any fears about cue cards. And I will say this, too. You're probably one of the best cue card readers that I've ever worked with because you've been doing it for so long.
Yeah.
And these closer looks, God, I mean, the numbers of cards you ramble through on a day-to-day basis, it's pretty impressive.
I should say, when we worked together at SNL, I would oftentimes write the cold open, which would oftentimes be the longest sketch of the show.
Right.
And you would never miss an opportunity to tell me how many cards I had made you write.
Yes.
This show obviously took a huge shift where we went from a show that did not have long sketches like A Closer Look, and now we have them very, you know, pretty much every show.
Correct.
So what has the jump of cards used per show gone for you?
Before we were doing Closer Looks three times a week, I would say the average on a day would be maybe 75 to 100 cue cards. Now with a closer look, on a closer look days, it probably goes from, when it goes from 75 to 100, probably to like 200 to 250 with changes and things like that. Yeah, so it's a big jump.
I mean, unless the one good thing about a closer look is there's only one set of cards.
This is true.
One of my favorite things here is there are a few times where you have written something or tried to squeeze a word in that makes it unreadable, and it has been nice to, basically because it's my show and I'm not costing anybody else time, it has been fun to have you be a living, breathing character on Late Night that I can then stop things and call you out.
I mean, that wasn't my intention, but I love having things written for me by the writers. But yeah, when we make mistakes, you're going to make mistakes. It's a human thing, and you understand that. I would rather you call me out and have fun with it than get mad at me, like, and not do anything, and then maybe yell at me after show, which you would never do.
No, but so, also, that's been the other nice thing about this show versus SNL is I think there were, when things went wrong at SNL because you had that one chance and
people get upset.
Yeah, you get upset. And so I have not felt that way for, I think I maybe felt that way for the first year here, but I think I've moved on from that.
It's more fun. And we try not to make mistakes, but it's funny because if it screws you up and you stop and you kind of laugh at it, I like that part of it too. Yeah.
And I also think people are always happy to see you because not only are you the cue card guy, you have been in multiple sketches since we started this show. Do you have any favorite acting performances?
I think the two that I really like are the one with the old cue card where you retired the cue card to the cue card farm.
Right.
Where you then shot it backstage and it wouldn't die. And then the other one where I dropped the cue cards, which I've never done, but then the chaos that ensued when I dropped the cue cards and you were trying to ramble and try to ad-lib stuff. That was a fun one too.
I was so nervous coming into the show, and there were a few touchstones that I had that made me feel calm and as though I knew what I was doing, and one of them was the fact you've been holding my cards from the very beginning and pretty much my entire career. I mean, the first card I read in 2001 at SNL you were holding. First of all, happy 5-year anniversary, but also happy, oh my goodness, I think we're coming up on maybe 19 years together.
That's crazy.
And so I've just been so lucky to have you, so thanks, buddy.
Thanks for having me, buddy. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Wally. That's it. Thanks for listening to this special podcast retrospective with Late Night staff and crew, and thank you for watching for the last 5 years.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night Podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.